Good morning. I'd like you to open your Bibles with me to Luke chapter 17. I talked to a preacher friend yesterday, told him I was coming here to speak. He said, rather sarcastically, "And how did you get on that program?" So what if my father-in-law is the director? I'm still glad to be on this lectureship. Brother McDowell, I appreciate your work on that passage in the book of Amos. Clarence and I went to school together. He hasn't aged as well as I have. Now, he was coming down to OVC part-time from Katanning while I was in school there at OVC, and I got to stay in their home once and appreciate their hospitality, and I'm glad to see them again. I must thank Emmanuel and the eldership here at Hillview Terrace and this congregation, and thank you as an audience for your attendance this morning. My topic is God's people in the army. As I understand it, the New Testament nowhere explicitly identifies the church as an army, but it is implied. Passages like, "Put on the whole armor of God and war a good warfare." We understand the song, "Onward Christian Soldiers." But what does it really mean to speak of God's people being like an army? Well, it means many things. If you were to click on the icon of an army, to use computer language, it would open up many different files. And I considered exhausting myself with that laundry list of items, but I chose not to go through that exercise. Instead, I want to talk about one biblical notion which attends this metaphor for Christian service. We had guests into our home last Friday evening, and it is routine for me to remind our girls how to behave and cover the usual do's and don'ts. But Friday night was different. My older daughter, Sydney, had compiled her own list of rules for the children who would be arriving and playing in her room. I only remember two of them: put back what you get out, and no spitting. I don't know how much the second activity there is engaged in. But Sydney learned the value of a code of conduct. My preparation for this lecture bent me in the direction of a code of conduct. And the more I studied, the more this topic endeared itself to me. What is a soldier's code of conduct? What ethic governs his life? What is the vow that his heart has made? What virtue dictates his course of action? How do you evaluate the career of a soldier? What makes a good soldier a good soldier? I want to make my case this morning for the code of conduct which governs God's people in the army. And I want to do it by defining it and then proving it and then answering a possible objection to it. Here in Luke chapter 17 is a parable. And it's not about a soldier, but a servant. Beginning at verse 7, Jesus taught, "Which of you, having a servant plowing or feeding cattle, will say unto him by and by when he has come from the field, 'Go and sit down to meat'? Will not rather he say unto him, 'Make ready wherewith I may sup, and gird thyself, and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink'? Does he thank the servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I trow not, or I think not. So likewise ye, when ye shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do.'" You can almost see the man stumble in from the fields wearing a hard day's work. His arms are sore, his feet ache, and he smells bad. Another man in dry clothes meets him at the barn and says, "Go inside, get cleaned up, fix my supper. Then you can eat." Well, an American laborer would file a grievance. Would you put up with that kind of treatment on the job site? But if that strikes you unfair, remember, the man in the parable is a servant, not an hourly wage worker. He was bought, not hired. His relationship with the other man is one of ownership and not contract. And so it is his duty to see to his master's needs first. Does he thank the slave, Jesus asked? Well, of course not. He doesn't get a thank you note, a day off, servant of the year award, and he doesn't go to sleep at night thinking, what a wonderful guy I am. He just did what he was supposed to do. Well, so likewise you, Jesus then says. There is something about a servant doing what is expected of him that offers an appealing description of the Christian life. Certain things are just expected of Christians. Jesus had to include this parable in his curriculum to the 12 disciples and to us, because there'll be times when our service to God isn't glamorous, isn't charming, isn't lucrative, isn't amusing. And when those times come, it's our duty to serve anyway. Now, we routinely operate by this rule. We know what it means. There are times we do things not for reward or recognition, but because it's required. What makes a mother clean up after her sick child? Is it fun? It's required. In 1912, when the Titanic sank, the boat filled with passengers, the lifeboats. Why did the men wait for the women and children to go first? Because it was expected of them. Why did our young men travel halfway around the globe and risk their lives in the jungles of Southeast Asia? A sense of duty. One of my favorite stories in Bill Bennett's Book of Virtues is a story he takes from an old Boy Scout book called Loyalty to a Brother. One of two brothers fighting in the same company in France fell by a German bullet. The brother who escaped asked permission of his commanding officer to go and bring his brother back. He's probably dead, said the officer. There's no use you risking your life to bring back his body. Well, the soldier persisted and his officer consented. But just as the soldier reached the lines with his brother wounded across his back, the wounded man died. There, you see, said the commanding officer, you risked your life for nothing. No, replied Tom, I did what he expected of me, and I have my reward. When I crept up to him and took him in my arms, he said, Tom, I knew you would come. I just felt you would come. There you have the gist of it all. Somebody expects something fine, noble, and unselfish of us. Loyalty involves obligations. Life may call upon us to do the expected deed. You know as well as I that there are circumstances that arise where we do something for another and we get nothing in return. This is the ethic of duty. It's doing what you're supposed to do. It's doing what you ought to do. It's performing the required service. It is performing the necessary task. Which brings me to God's people in the army. Here is my contention, my case. I believe that the soldier's code of conduct is duty. Duty is the ethic which governs the life of a soldier. Duty is the virtue which dictates his course of action. Duty is how you describe him. How well he performed his duties is how you evaluate a soldier. And so to speak of God's people in the army, we speak of people who are people of duty. Now, can that be proven? That is, my claim that a soldier's ethic is the ethic of duty. Is there any corroborating evidence? Well, let's use an Old Testament soldier as a test case. If you'd like to turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 11. If you're looking for the model soldier, he stands at attention at 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 39. His name is the last in a list of soldiers called King David's mighty men. Together they formed a small contingent of specialized warriors, and the name of Uriah the Hittite is probably number one on the name recognition list. Uriah was the husband of Bathsheba, and you know the story of 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. It's about two soldiers, one who did his duty and one who did not. Beginning at verse 2, the text reads, "It came to pass in eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, 'Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?' And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness. She returned into her house. The woman conceived and sent and told David and said, 'I am with child.'" To cover his sin, David brings Uriah back from the battlefield. He insists that Uriah go home to be with his wife. Now, to the Bible reader, we know David's intentions, and so his actions make perfect sense. But Uriah doesn't know David's intentions. Uriah is ignorant of the affair. How can he make sense of David's actions? From Uriah's viewpoint, how does he see David's conduct? Just what was Uriah thinking when he got pulled off the battle line? Had he ever left when the fight was on before? What was Uriah thinking when David insisted, not once, but after getting him drunk twice, that he go home? What was Uriah thinking? The only feat he accomplished was carrying a letter. Just what was Uriah thinking when David treated him, a tactical warrior, like a messenger boy and sent a letter back to the battlefield? Didn't the king have couriers to run those errands? And wasn't Uriah the least bit curious about the content of the letter he carried? Didn't David's actions arise suspicions? But David knew Uriah would not read the letter. And Joab knew that Uriah did not read the letter. And just what was Uriah thinking when Joab commanded the battlefield maneuver, which in verses 16 through 21, Joab seems to imply was unwise, even in the judgment of a military novice? Well, the answer is we don't know what Uriah was thinking. We only know what Uriah was. He was a soldier. And soldiers do what they're supposed to do. You remember his protest when David insisted that he go home to be with his wife. It reveals his heart. It reveals his strict adherence to duty. He replied to David in verse 11, "The ark, Israel, and Judah abide in tents. My lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house, eat, drink, and lie with my wife? As your soul lives, O king, I will not do this thing." That's a man of duty talking. Uriah the Hittite, his biography proves my claim, proves the biblical notion that a soldier's ethic is duty. Remember what Paul charged Timothy: "No man that warreth entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier." It is this compulsive drive to please his superior by performing his duties that describes the career of a good soldier. Uriah's biography reminds me of Alfred Tennyson's famous war poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. He based it on the Battle of Balaklava, fought October 25, 1854, during the Crimean War. And he speaks of a battalion of soldiers, the Light Brigade, who made an assault against a Russian artillery line. daring, but disastrous. Only 195 of 673 were left standing. Notice how Tennyson, though, describes the code of conduct of the Light Brigade in the third stanza of the poem. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. That is the virtue of a soldier. That's his code of conduct. Not to reason why, not to make reply, but if need be, to do and die. Now, I know that all this doesn't play well in some circles of our American culture. Many circles of our society would be unimpressed with the virtue of duty. Some would examine the biography of Uriah and call into question anybody who would set it forth as an example. Well, Uriah, he was just stupidly and blindly following orders. His allegiance was ignorant. Why are you going to hold forth Uriah the Hittite as an example? His loyalty was reckless. He should have smelled a rat. His actions weren't courageous. They were foolish. I understand that viewpoint. And this example is a big target. If someone wants to aim at Uriah the Hittite and call him a fool, they have the liberty to do so. But I'll tell you this much. The strict adherence to the ethic of duty, which defined the life of Uriah the Hittite, endears itself to me. And I'm attracted to it because I'm sick to death of hearing of people who have no sense of duty, of men whose conscience isn't nudged a bit by a sense of what they ought to do, who will only do something for another if it gets them something in return, who are only attracted to deeds that are glamorous or charming or amuse them. So I don't feel any shame in holding up Uriah the Hittite as an example. Say what you will about him, but he strictly adhered to the code of conduct of duty. And our generation, my generation, would be better off if we had men and women operating by this ethic. Now, I'd like to answer a possible objection to what I think is the biblical notion that duty should serve God's people in the army as an ethic to govern their actions. The objection from a critic might go something like this. What about love? Love is the supreme Christian motive. Love is the number one Christian ethic. Ideally speaking, shouldn't we be driven by the loving thing as opposed to the dutiful thing? Well, that's a worthy objection. What is the relationship between love and duty? How does the course of action called for by the ethic of love differ from the course of action called for by the ethic of duty? Well, I would insist that those two courses of action aren't different at all. I don't think there's a contradiction at all. I think, in real terms, duty is equated with love. That the ethic of duty calls forth the same course of action as the ethic of love. Now, the reason perhaps some have trouble with this, trouble equating duty with love, is that duty doesn't always come with warm, fuzzy feelings, with dreamy, sentimental emotions in the pit of the stomach. And they reason, you can't remove the warm, fuzzy feelings from love and still call it love any more than you can remove the stripes from a zebra and still call him a zebra. But that analogy is flawed. Stripes define a zebra. Remove the stripes and you do have a different animal. But the warm, fuzzy feelings do not define love. Remove them, you still got what you had. In fact, I would make the case what you've got is the motive of love, bare, naked, undressed, that cannot be mistaken for anything else. The substance of what the Bible calls love is duty. Someone might say, how can an act born of necessity be an act of love? I would turn that question on its head. How can an act born of necessity not be anything but an act of love? An act that's performed not for money, not for fame, not for glamour, not because it's amusing, not because it's charming, not because it's convenient, not because it's self-advantageous. An act performed only because it's necessary. Can it be attributed to any other motive in the Christian life context? To illustrate, one young husband stands at the door of his house with a bouquet of roses to surprise his wife. That's an act of love. Another husband, age 80, whose wife has had two strokes, changes her soiled clothes, kneels down at her bedside, and wipes the drool off her chin. An act of love. Now you tell me, which was the act born of necessity? Which husband did the dutiful thing? And then answer the question, which is the greater act of love? An act of real duty is an act of love. There is no difference between the two virtues in the context of the Christian life. Both ethics prescribe the same course of action in a given circumstance. The cornerstone piece of evidence, in my judgment, which equates the virtue of love with the virtue of duty, is the cross of Christ. Last text I want to take you to is 1 John chapter 3, verse 16. What motive drove Jesus to Calvary? Love. Not every Bible verse that tells what Jesus did tells why he did it. But as I read, every verse that does tell why he did it reveals the lone motive to be love. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, John 3:16. God demonstrates his own love in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, Romans chapter 5 and verse 8. And then here in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16. You know, we're accustomed to thinking of love as it's defined by the Hollywood box office or magazine covers. And we need to be careful about adopting an unbiblical notion of what the motive of love is. Those things are false notions. There was nothing romantic about the scourging of Jesus. There was no soft song played in the background to accompany his walk down the Jerusalem street out to Calvary. The crucifixion was no dreamy, sentimental thing. It wasn't charming. It wouldn't have played to the cameras. There was nothing amusing, attractive about it. It was a soldier-like act of duty. But it was the greatest act of love ever performed. Here in 1 John 3:16, the Apostle John tangles up the virtue of love with the virtue of duty. By this we know love. John is about to define love. Because he laid down his life for us. That is it. The event of Jesus' crucifixion defines love. And what John wants to say next binds an obligation upon every Christian. And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Notice that word ought in 1 John 3:16. That's a separate Greek word. The word ought. Ought communicates obligation. Ought means this is our duty. Ought means this is what's expected, what we're supposed to do, what's required. And so the virtue of love in 1 John 3:16 gets all tangled up with the virtue of duty, and you can't tell one from the other. John, I thought we were supposed to love our brethren. What are you talking about the word ought for and duty? Same thing. Duty and love are twin virtues. To be governed by one is to be governed by the other. You show me the man who does the dutiful thing, I'll show you the man who does the loving thing. Well, someone might ask, is there honor to be found in operating your life by the ethic of duty? If you're going to describe Christian service like this, if you're going to frame the life of discipleship as having your course of action always dictated by what is the dutiful thing, is there honor to be found in that? When a woman does the necessary thing, what does that say about her? When a Christian man strictly adheres to duty as a code of conduct, what does it say about him? Nathan Hale was a soldier. And he has a quote that I like. He's a famous soldier, you know his name, in the Revolutionary War, captured by the British, executed for espionage. He's famous for saying, I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country. But I like something else he said better. In the fall of 1776, General George Washington desperately needed to learn the intentions of the British forces which occupied Long Island, New York. He stood in front of a regiment of soldiers and asked for a volunteer for an intelligence mission behind enemy lines. He needed a spy. At first call, there were no volunteers. At second call, Nathan Hale alone stepped forward. And later, his friend questioned his decision. And he said, in a sense, you know this is a crazy thing. Why did you volunteer? Why in the world would you have stepped forward? In defense of his decision, Nathan Hale said this, I wish to be useful in every kind of service necessary to the public good becomes honorable by being necessary. Becomes honorable by being necessary. If I might borrow that language. Every kind of service necessary to the good of the kingdom of God becomes honorable by being necessary. God's people in the army are people who perform daily, often unattractive, but necessary tasks. A deed doesn't have to be glamorous to be heroic. It doesn't have to be congratulated to be honorable. It doesn't have to be noticed by men to be noticed by God. Great men aren't just men who perform wonderful feats. Great men are men who perform ordinary feats wonderfully. Great women aren't just women who perform wonderful feats. Great women are women who perform ordinary feats wonderfully. I know men like that. I know women like that. You know men like that. You know women like that. These are God's people in the army who hold to a code of conduct called duty, who operate by the ethic of duty, who allow the virtue of duty to dictate their course of action. That's how a good soldier can be called a good soldier. I appreciate your attention this morning.